All right. If you've ever heard of the bands Metallica, Slayer, Cannibal Corpse, this is where they got their start. Brian Slagle is the founder of Metal Blade Records, and I'd say heavy metal's longest-serving label dedicated to the cause. A couple years ago, he released an autobiography titled For the Sake of Heaviness. He's in California, I'm in New South Wales, and it's good to have you here today, Brian.
Thanks for having me, man.
So, look, let's just start with some current events. Stanley Cup Finals are on. We've got the Blues playing Boston, which is, I believe, technically a repeat of the Stanley Cup Finals from, I don't know, something like 1975.
74, 75.
So, for a lot of people, this will be the first introduction to you, and so we'll go through the history sort of a new wave of British heavy metal into thrash and your dealings with, you know, a lot of these guys that are household names. But what a lot of people are surprised to find out about you outside of your music interests is apparently you're a hockey diehard, which is really, really interesting to find out, first of all, from an American who's not sort of based in one of the northern five states like, you know, Michigan or Wisconsin or upper New York.
Yes, I get that a lot, especially, I mean, it's a little bit different now because there's hockey everywhere, but when I first started becoming a hockey fanatic in the 80s, people are like, you're in LA, and you're crazy about hockey, like, how does that happen? Where are you from, somewhere else? I go, no, I grew up in LA, but I just was drawn to the sport. I ended up getting season tickets. It's kind of, it's a weird long story, but a friend of mine who was a printer, this is back in the early 80s, he was a printer, he would do all the printing for the Kings. They like Kings and the Lakers, and they would just, instead of paying for this kind of the barter system, they just give him tickets, and nobody cared about the Kings at that point, so they gave him season tickets, and he didn't want them. He said, do you want these? I'm like, sure. So I started going to the games, and then that increased my obsession greatly.
Hanneman was a big fan, especially of LA-based teams. Did you guys follow, I think Kings big into the Raiders in football. I assume that you guys have always had a lot of stuff to chat about that.
Sure. Well, King is also a big hockey guy, too. We actually kind of sort of share season tickets for the Vegas Golden Knights, although he doesn't use them as often. But, yeah, he's a big hockey guy, too. And, yeah, Hanneman was a huge hockey fan. In fact, I was able to get him into the Stanley Cup Finals when the Kings were in, which, you know, none of us ever thought in our lifetime would happen. So there's a few musicians out there that are big hockey fans. My buddy Lizzie Borden is a huge hockey fan. He goes to all the Knights games with me.
How did
there's some out there.
How did Vegas sort of develop this following so quickly? Because even like I'm a big Pantera fan, and Vinnie Paul seems to have been buried with his gravestone that's been laid also seems to have the Knights on it. But I remember the stories of Pantera were then parting with the Dallas Stars. So how have the Knights sort of become this sort of default team for a lot of guys after only a couple seasons now?
Well, you know, a lot of people come to Vegas and live in Vegas. I'm pretty much living in Vegas now as well. So when one of the precursors for me even, I mean, I didn't really intend to live out here. So that's another long story. I just kind of ended up here because there's no traffic and people are nice. I'm like Los Angeles. Right. But, and one of the prerequisites, of course, I can't live anywhere where there's not a NHL hockey team. So, but I didn't really think they were going to be that good. I don't think any of us thought they were going to be that good. And it just was this whole magic season last year. You know, Vinny lives out here. So he goes to all the games and there's, what I love seeing is guys who weren't really big hockey fans before that all of a sudden when the Knights came here became a huge hockey fan. Like one of my good friends is Chris Kale, who's a bass player from Five Finger Death Punch, and who's a huge metalhead and a great dude. And he had never been to a hockey game, had never even really seen hockey until the Knights got here. And now he's completely fanatical about everything. So I love seeing that.
And what do you reckon about the finals? Are you people like me? We're happy to see, very happy to see the Caps finally get a title. I'm a Canucks supporter naturally, so never had any cup silverware there. So I like the idea of the Blues getting through. But Boston has a original six team. They've got a lot of fans based everywhere.
Yeah, it's well. The weird thing about Boston is, so if the Bruins win, which I think they will. That means that Boston will have the World Series, the Super Bowl, and the Stanley Cup all in the same year. So I'm not sure if that's ever been done before where one city has three of the four major titles. But, yeah, I'd like to see St. Louis win, but I just don't think that they quite have enough. And they don't have the experience where Boston has a bunch of guys who have been there before, done it. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
And Tuukka Rask is a metalhead, so I guess we kind of
is he really? Yeah, right.
Yeah, he's okay. A big metalhead. If you look on the back of his mask, it says Tuukka in the Metallica lettering.
Oh, I've not seen that. Yeah, right. Well, I guess it makes sense. Scandinavian countries, I suppose it's the half the albums that debut out there still chart within the top five. So I guess it makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Well, look, a lot of people, the people that are probably going to initially listen to this will know who you are, but there's a lot of people that won't. So do you want to, I guess, just give a sort of a breakdown of, you know, how you got into heavy metal initially and how that ended up forming the basis of a business for you?
Well, I was growing up as a kid, I wasn't really a huge music fan. Like, nobody in my family was really a musician, and you know, there wasn't much a lot of music going on in my household. But when I was 11, I went to one of my cousin's houses, and he had just bought an album by a band called Deep Purple named Machine Head, and he put it on for me, played it. I went, "What is this most amazing thing I'd ever heard in my entire life?" So the next day, of course, I immediately went down and bought it somewhere for $1 or something. And that became my obsession with heavy music. And I went from Deep Purple to Black Sabbath to, you know, all the 70s stuff, Priest, you know, UFO. And then it kind of culminated in the new wave of British heavy metal scene that was happening in the early 80s, where I got completely obsessed with that. And from that, I kind of fell into this whole record label thing, which was never my intention.
Right. Okay. So, so how does that end up happening? I think we're leaving a lot of a gap there. You start becoming a fan of these, but it's a lot is based on like where you're located and how you end up becoming friends with a lot of these guys, as I said, who are now traveling the world.
Yeah. Right place at the right time, basically. Well, I was a big fan. Like I said, I was a big fan of the new wave of British heavy metal. I started a fan, the very first American heavy metal fanzine called the New Heavy Metal Review, REVUE, don't ask why, that's just what I called it, and started getting really into, you know, a lot of the bands and interviewing bands, but I was kind of focusing more on what was happening over in Europe, and I was also right around that same time started working at a record store. And I was selling all the import heavy metal stuff from Europe and, you know, the Merciful Fate and all, you know, Iron Maiden and everything in there. So one day, and I had all these people that were coming to the record store. And one day, a friend of mine who had been, was there buying a bunch of stuff, said, "Hey, you know, there's some metal bands playing here in LA." And there is. I mean, when I was in high school, there was, you know, Quiet Riot and a couple of other bands, but he said, yeah. So I went down to a place called the Troubadour, which, you know, if nobody's heard of it, it's everybody from Elton John to all the metal bands played there. I went down there on a Wednesday night, and I saw Motley Crue and Rat for $1. And I was like, oh, wow, there actually are some good metal bands in L.A. And that, and then as that kind of formed, and I see, you know, more bands coming around. And it was, you know, this is 1981, 82, and it was way before the internet or anything else. So nobody knew that this scene existed. Like, nobody had any clue. So I kind of thought, well, maybe based on my love of the new wave of British heavy metal, and a lot of that was do-it-yourself. You know, bands were doing singles themselves. There were, like, little tiny labels propping up doing compilations. And I was kind of inspired by that, and I thought, well, maybe if I put together a compilation album of local LA heavy metal bands, people might know that there's something exists here. These bands might be heard by somebody other than the, you know, 100 people at the gig. So I decided to put out a record, and that record became Metal Massacre, and it had Rat and Bitch and Sir Thungle and a whole bunch of bands on it, including a band named Metallica. And how that happened was Michael Schenker Group played a show at the Country Club in Reseda in December of 1980. And at that show was a kid who had just moved from Denmark to Los Angeles named Lars Ulrich. And I went with my friend John Cornerens, who was probably the only other guy that knew anything about the new wave of British heavy metal. So after the show, he sees a kid in the parking lot wearing a Saxon European t-shirt. Now, nobody in L.A. knew who Saxon was, let alone had a European t-shirt of them. So we ran up and said, "Oh, my God, where'd you get that?" He said, "Hey, I just moved here from Denmark. I'm, you know who Saxon is, and bigger than that." I said, "Yeah, you got me meet my friend Brian." So the next day we all hung out together and just became friends based on our love of the new wave of British heavy metal and heavy metal music. And then as I started to put together this compilation idea, album idea, he called me and said, "Hey, if I could put together a band, can I be on your record?" I'm like, "Sure." And of course that led to Metallica happening.
So what, you know, to put out a sampler, and, you know, these guys ended up, I think Metallica, I don't know if it's the same imprint, but it was Elektra, I think, at the time, or I don't know who owns them, but how did you take a sampler to, I guess, not signing some of these guys to full-fledged, and what was the next step for you to, you know, legitimize it into a business?
Well, I was just a fan. I didn't know anything about business. I didn't have any contracts in the beginning. And I never intended to have a record label. I was just trying to help bands however I could. But I made every mistake possible on that first album. And so one of the distributors knew and said, hey, you know, we know you don't have any money. I had no money, by the way, either. I barely scraped enough to put together 2,500 copies of it. So we know you don't have any money, but you seem like you kind of know what's going on. We'll give you what's called a pressing and distribution deal, where you just bring us stuff and we'll actually manufacture and distribute it for you. So I thought, okay, well, I can do that. So I just started going around to bands that I knew in LA and say, hey, if you guys can somehow record something, I can put it out. Again, you know, with no money, I had to rely on them to be able to somehow get some studio time or rustle up a little bit of money from somewhere and actually record something. And then that's kind of how it happened. Put out a band called Bitch was the first full release, then Armored Saint. Then we did some more compilation albums, and then we ended up signing a band called Slayer.
And so what happens between turning this into a hobby and into a full-fledged business? Was there a particular time when you went, okay, this is what we do now?
Well, I was doing it out of my mom's garage for about 3 years, just by myself, doing anything and everything. I was, you know, doing all the marketing, promotion, designs, layouts, manufacturing. I mean, you know, anything that is involved in a record label, I was doing it all myself. And just because I was a huge fan, and it was fun because I was, you know, discovering all these cool new bands and helping them out. There's kind of the scene. So I was still working at the record store, and I was still living at my mom's house. So I didn't really think that this was going to be anything other than, you know, I'm a 21-year-old kid at the time just trying to help people out. And it's fun to turn people on to new bands and start working with the bands. I can't play an instrument, so I figured the next best thing I'd do is try to help out some other way.
Sure.
So I started doing it. After about 3 years, it kind of started to get a little bit bigger. And then it got to the point where, wow, I think I actually need to hire an actual employee, and I think I need to move to, like, an actual office and not be, you know, in the garage behind my mom's house. So I think once there was an office and employee, I was like, well, maybe this is something. That took 3 years just to get to that point. So
yeah, okay.
It was a slow burn for sure.
So I think a lot of people then will ask the question, it's like, so if you're working with Metallica and Slayer, how do you lose them, or why would you let them go? So a lot of this has to do with, you know, money and how these deals are structured. So what's sort of going on at this time, and why are outside labels attracted to these guys?
Sure. Well, in the case of Metallica, I mean, that was just purely a money thing where I didn't have any money and they didn't have any money. So there was no way, because they said, hey, we'd love to do a full record. I said, I'd love to do a full record with you, but neither of us have any money. So there's no way to really do it. There's no way at that point to get money. Again, we're all just young kids with no credit, and we didn't have, you know, parents didn't have any money. Like, nobody had money. So we ended up not being able to sign them, and they ended up moving to San Francisco and got an offer from a company in New York that had a little bit of money. So they ended up playing with them. And what the case with Slayer was, and this was a case to, you know, a ton of bands in the 80s. I mean, we were still, it was a very small label. It was me and, you know, probably had four or five people. It was a small, tiny little independent label. And when the major labels started to really get involved in this music in the, you know, kind of towards the mid to late 80s, you know, I can't compete with a major label. I felt it was unfair for me to try to hold on to these bands. I mean, look, if you have a great opportunity, you're going to sign with a major label, then you should do that. And that's, you know, where bands like Slayer and, you know, Flotsam and Jetsam and Cigar, I mean, there's, you know, probably 20 of them, Trouble, that all went there. And I was happy for them. And, you know, I did my job to, you know, get them started and have some things happening. And then it only made sense for them to graduate to the next level. Of course, it's a lot different now. Now we've kind of grown into this, you know, real label, and it's kind of a hybrid between an independent and a major now. So it's a whole different thing. But back then, I was just happy that the bands could be successful. And I certainly could not compete with what the major labels were offering.
Yeah, right. What was going on in the scene? Because, I mean, what are we're talking, what, 81, 82 probably at this sort of very early point?
Yeah, the early point was 82. The Metal Massacre record came out in 1982. And, you know, there was just a lot of, like, in L.A., you had Motley Crue and Rat and those bands playing, and then a whole bunch of other bands like Bitch and Steeler and Malice, a whole bunch of these bands, all from L.A., which was kind of surprising. Metallica was playing as well, even though they weren't as well received because people thought that they were too heavy, actually. So they were kind of a bit of a fish out of water, which is why they ended up going to San Francisco. You also had Armored Saints, so it was this incredible amount of really good bands playing around LA. So everybody's just doing it for the love of the music. There wasn't any, none of us ever thought this was going to grow into anything, that any of these bands would be successful. I mean, even Motley Crue, you know, their management, because they worked a lot. I worked a lot with them with the fanzine, and they actually were supposed to be on the first Metal Master album, but their management had enough money to be able to record a record, and they actually came to my mom's house and sat on my mom's couch and said, "Hey, we have 900 Motley Crue records that we've manufactured. What do we do with them?" And at the time, I said, "Hey, take them to this distributor I know named Green World, and they'll help you out." And of course, if I knew, you know, then what I knew now, it might have been a different story. But they went off, and even for them, it took them a little while to really kind of make it happen. But slowly but surely, over a couple of years, it started to become something.
And so what was the big, cause you know, when I look at sort of a lot of the classic albums from this, there's the sort of bridge to thrash from stuff like Maiden and Motorhead is quite extreme, but between sort of like this 2 to 3 year period, the music got a lot more aggressive. Was there anything, I guess sort of going on of what led to, you know, cause thrash and speed is really quite a departure from new wave of British heavy metal, and certainly doesn't really share any commonalities with glam.
Punk rock.
Okay.
So what happened with bands like, especially with bands like Metallica and Slayer, where they were heavily influenced by the new wave of British heavy metal and by the, you know, the Judas Priests and obviously the remains of the world. But there were some elements of punk rock that, you know, James Hetfield was into, you know, a lot of this old punk rock stuff, you know, Black Flag and the Misfits and all these sort of things. And same thing with Jeff Hanneman from Slayer, where he had a background of liking a lot of punk rock stuff.
He had the Dead Kennedy sticker on his guitar. And like, I still think, I was listening to Undisputed Attitude the other day. I still think that's a ripper of a sort of like a true crossover record.
Oh, absolutely. And so so that element came in, and that's what kind of separated those bands and that scene that got a lot of, and the whole thrash scene that came after that was all those bands were, as much as they loved the classic metal stuff, there's also this element of punk rock music. And, you know, in San Francisco, you had the Dead Kennedys, who, when I was growing up, going to high school, I was also into both metal and punk rock. And, you know, living in LA, the Dead Kennedys would come down once a month and play. And they were still my all-time favorite punk rock band. And obviously them being in San Francisco, they had a huge influence on all those bands, you know, the Testaments and Exoduses and even Metallica when they went up there and played as well. So that's really what made it heavier and edgier. And I think also those bands wanted to, you know, subconsciously be different than the European bands. Like, you know, I think they didn't want to just be a copy of Diamond Head or Maiden or that stuff. So the punk rock element really came in, and that's what gave it that extra edge.
Mm. So was when Metallica did the Metal Up Your Ass EP, was that independent or were you associated with that at any point in time?
No, when they did the first record, they signed to a small label called Megaforce Records. Which
That's
was
right.
This guy, John.
Because Anthrax was there, wasn't it?
They were there as well.
Yeah.
Yep, they were New York based as well. And then we had talked to Anthrax, had Exodus and a lot of those bands. But John Zazula had amassed a couple $1,000 and somehow convinced those guys to drive cross country record. So I wasn't involved with that whatsoever. It's really my only involvement was in the very first track. But I've remained very good friends with those guys over all the years, and they've been very nice to me as far as, you know, helping them getting them started and, you know, helping out since then on.
Well, I got to tell you my Metal Blade story, because there's no one else that I know that has a similar story. And that is, you know, when I was growing up in Canada, a lot of the Metal Blade catalog originally, I wasn't even aware of it. And certainly a lot of it wasn't available in a lot of the mainstream stores. Like in Canada, we had HMV, Sam the Record Man. It was pretty hard to get some of that stuff at the time. But when I was in my teens, I ended up subscribing to, you know, those mail away record clubs like Columbia House and BMG. And I just, particularly with BMG seemed to license a lot of your titles. And so you'd get like the monthly catalog that would come in and you'd drop straight into metal. And of course, all the sales were, you know, if you buy one at regular price and they'd charge $25 for a licensed CD, but then they give you like two or three off the back of there. And that's where I started finding out about, you know, 6 Feet Under Haunted, which I still think is probably the pinnacle of sort of mid-tempo, high production death metal, King Diamond, and another one of my favorites, guys like Grip Inc., which unfortunately didn't last very long. how were you guys expanding your business around that point in time? Because when I talk to other people, no one even remembers these sort of mail away record clubs, which is where I got exposed to, you know, a lot of your product.
Well, when that was happening, so by the end of the 80s, as I mentioned, we'd lost so many bands to the major labels, and some of them worked out. Most of them did not. So we kind of got a little tired of losing them to the majors and then having the majors not know what to do with them. So we ended up doing a partnership deal with Warner Brothers Records where, you know, felt, all right, we might as well associate a partnership with one of the big majors so that way we can keep the bands instead of losing them. And when we went to Warner's, because that became a whole different ballgame, because we were just like an independent label with independent distribution. When you get to Warner's, you actually have Warner's distribution and all these other angles like the record clubs, which, you know, we never would have been able to get into except for the fact that we were with Warner's and Warner's was distributing us now. So we could get into those things. So that kind of opened up a lot of stuff in the 90s for us in terms of getting of distribution and getting into real stores and just kind of – and my attitude at that point was, you know, anything we could do to help promote the music, whether it was, like you said, the BMG and Columbia House, I think, was the other one. Just anything we could do to get the records out there so people could listen to the music, we would end up doing. And we jumped on all those opportunities as fast as we could.
And a lot of people would, like myself, would like to understand a little bit more about how the business of this works. So when you say partnership, what does that mean? Are they just doing the transport, the distribution of the records? Or how are those deals typically structured where you retain, you know, the IP, but they're taking a cut of it?
Well, that was an interesting deal. So what we did with them, we did basically a three-tiered deal. And this was, you know, I guess, you call it revolutionary at the time, but it happens a lot now. But it was a three-tiered deal where we had the bottom tier was stuff that was just going to be too heavy and didn't make any sense to be through Warner Brothers Records. So, well, actually, technically four tiers because that stuff we put through an independent distribution. And then we had one level that was only distribution, and all they did was do distribution. Then we had a second tier where they would do distribution, but they'd also help with the marketing promotion of it. And there was a third level where it was more of a joint venture, where once a band got to a certain point, then they would really come in, and it would basically – they would act as Warner Brothers Records partnering with us to do something. And that was – the Goo Goo Dolls is probably the best example of that.
We'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah. So that was kind of the way we did it. And it worked out really great because we had all these opportunities to get into all the record stores and have, you know, some money behind us and a bunch of things. It worked out really great until Ice-T put out the record Cop Killer.
Yes.
And
but wait, that
sudden,
was just the track. That wasn't the song, though, was it? Because Body Count, that wasn't the name of the album.
It was Body Count, yeah. That was the big song that was out there that was Ice-T's metal band, Body Count. And that was on Warner Brothers. And that became a huge thing. And then all of a sudden, we started freaking out about this. And Warner Brothers had just been sold to this gigantic company called Time Inc., which is this massive conglomerate. And, you know, everybody's like freaking out. They're, you know, talking about Trump dropping Ice-T from the label. And, you know, people are saying they're not going to carry Warner Brothers Records. So anyway, so they decided to, at that point, have some lawyers look at every single release that came through the Warner Brothers network to decide if the lyrics and content were deemed okay. So the first record that we put out, of course, was a Guar record. And they came to me and said, okay, you have to take this song off. You have to change the lyrics to this song. And I said, well, that's not going to work for me. I'm not going to censor artists. They're going to put out whatever they put out. So I went to their credit, went to Mo Austin and Lenny Warnker, the two legendary guys that were owning Warner Brothers at the time. I said, like, look, if this is the way it's going to be, I can't be here. And they were completely understanding. I said, completely understand what you're saying. We don't like this either. And, you know, go on your merry way. So anyway, that was our time with Warner's. But it did help grow the label to a much larger point.
Right. Okay. Look, you mentioned some of these bands. I mean, for older fans like myself, you know, it's sort of like the early to mid 90s were the peak of sort of death metal, where you guys were certainly one of the key labels in that. You know, Morbid Angel signed to big guys as well. And I think it's Domination that I'm thinking of. That album came and then they just sort of dropped off. So when you talk about larger labels not being able to manage, do you think that the appetite went away for it, or do you think it really was just about not marketing this to the next level at the time?
Yeah, they didn't. I mean, in quite all honesty, most of them didn't know what was going on. They just saw that there were sales somewhere and something was happening, so they all kind of got in on it, but they didn't know what to do with it. And we kind of, you know, started to help do some marketing and promotion there. And that was part of it. But in all honesty, the other big part of it was grunge. You know, grunge came in the 90s and just completely obliterated anything that metal was doing at that point, any sort of metal, which kind of was okay in a weird way for me because metal had kind of become, for the most part, obviously aside from the death metal and Pantera and those things, it kind of become a joke of itself. You know, bands like Warrant and, you know, all these horrible bands that were called metal, which were just complete jokes. So that kind of ruined everything. And the heavier bands that ended up signing, you know, Corrosion Conformity is another good example. The majors just didn't know what to do with them. They had no clue. They say, hey, this has been selling records, so let's sign them and do something with them. And then they got it and they said, well, now what do we do?
Yeah, right. I remember this like trifecta of bands that would always, so Metallica, and oftentimes they'd have Corrosion open for them. And then when Corrosion went on their own headline tour, it would be Clutch that would open for them. And it was just sort of these sort of, I remember like about like five or six bands that every time I go see them play live, it was always one was opening for the other. And then it was an interesting time sort of around then. Let's talk about sort of the state of, how deals are done today. Because from my point of view, and it's, you know, you'd be in on this, that there's a lot of artists complaining about Spotify. So if we go all the way back to Napster, there's Napster illegal downloading. And then I remember for a few years, what, in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was like if you bought the CD, then you could get a realistic download, but you still couldn't copy the CD. Then we started getting into sort of, you know, Apple-based products to the point that we're now on things like Spotify, where it's literally just free streaming, where in order to make any money, the band has to be streamed about a million times to be able to get anything back. So what I'm leading to is, first of all, there seems to be some sort of area for LPs these days. Some people seem to be buying cassettes. Are CDs still part of the process now? Is it all digital? Are people paying for music at all?
Yes, people are paying music for music now more than in the last 25 years.
Really? Okay.
And yeah, I think this is where the issue lies with streaming companies. Is there's a lot of money being generated and made by these streaming companies. A lot of money. And unfortunately, the bands, if you're signed to a lot of other labels, the labels are not giving the money down to the bands. Because there's more money now being – I mean, I just see where our numbers are. And our numbers are the biggest they've been in 15 years. And every label, the major labels, and you look at the overall music business is bigger than it's ever been. For the first time ever, you have venture capital people running around trying to throw a bunch of money to get involved in the music business, which I've never seen in 38 years of doing this. So there's a lot of money being generated now. The problem is that not all of it's being kicked down to the band. Of the bigger bands, Drake, Adele, excuse me, you name it, and they're making hundreds of millions of dollars off of streaming. But the smaller bands are not making as much yet, but it's slowly getting there. I think part of the problem is some bands, especially I know bands on major labels that are kind of mid-level bands, you know, they're getting paid probably a very, very small percentage of what the label is getting, which is not right in my opinion. But you're starting to see, I mean, we're starting to give checks to bands now that are pretty significant checks now all of a sudden, where it's like the bands are getting more royalties now than they have in a long period of time. So I think initially it was exactly how you're saying, because we even noticed like until a couple of years ago, like we're not going to do a deal with one of these companies because they're not paying anybody anything except unless you're a major label.
So how does that work? So if we think
– but that's quickly changing now. But it's up to the bands – to kind of try to, and the managers to negotiate renegotiate proper deals. And that, you know, that can be a little tricky, especially if you're with a major label.
Okay. So trying to, for people like myself who don't work in this world, wrapping my head around it. So let's say, you know, because how do you work with that as an artist? You go on Spotify, it's by artist. If I go on YouTube, there is a Metal Blade channel, but then your artists also have a channel. Then on places like YouTube, you see a lot of re-uploading of content, and some labels are pretty stringent in pulling that down while other ones sort of let it slide. So do artists then make a direct cut if they upload on YouTube, or is that still split with the label? And how sort of who decides whether it's a brand or band promotion versus a guy in his basement who then uploads a full
Yeah. Well, YouTube is very tricky, and YouTube is a big problem at the moment, quite honestly, because they, number one, don't pay nearly what Spotify or Apple Music or any of those people pay. They pay a small, tiny percentage of that. So theoretically, this is the way it more or less works. So if you if there's a song out there, let's say Amon Amarth has a song called Cracked Sky. It's out there. So wherever that lives on YouTube, they're supposed to, and of course we can't ever tell, but they're supposed to, and definitely the companies that we deal with that do the digital processing and accounting, they actually know the algorithms and how much things are being played. It's a whole kind of complex technical thing where they know anytime something is uploaded, it's called fingerprinting, and that song is fingerprinted, and it, no matter who uploads it, it's the money's supposed to eventually trickle down to the label and then to the artist, which it does. However, with YouTube, they don't pay a whole lot of money for music. Now, if an artist goes up and puts them talking for 5 minutes about something, and there's no music involved, then they can get paid if they have the YouTube channel they can get paid for that sort of thing. So that's how you find these people, YouTube people that just post random stuff up there. They're making a ton of money because they have millions of people following them.
So some artists are really now able to monetize their media and interviews if they're big enough.
They can if they do it the right way. What's really interesting is the technology is becoming very fascinating now. There's a new site now called Twitch. And what Twitch is Twitch started out as basically a place for people to go watch people play games. And that's obviously become a huge thing now where people pay to watch people play video games, which is – I'm not a video game guy, so I find that odd, but it's become a huge thing. So now we're seeing artists that are going up there, specifically guitar players are really good at this. The guitar players will go up there and they'll post them giving guitar lessons or explaining how they wrote songs.
What's his name?
How they do different things.
Ole England of The Haunted is a huge on this online.
He's doing that, and Herman Lee from Dragon Force, who's right. with us, and so he's doing a big numbers, and Matt Hafey from Trivium as well. And these guys are like putting in pretty significant time and effort to do this, and they're coming out with a pretty decent amount of money. So there's all sorts of different ways with technology now. If you're doing it the right way and you're smart enough, you can make money. And there's definitely more money being generated now in the music business than there has in a long, long time. It's just going to take some of the bands a while to see it all trickle down to them. But it's coming. It's definitely coming, if not there already. Because, I mean, we have bands on our label that I've argued with over the years, like, we're never going to make any money on Spotify. It's never going to happen. And sure enough, you know, we would write them a pretty large check. And I go, remember what you said? You weren't going to make any money.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Spotify, what about this, like, you know, $50,000 you guys just got it, whatever the number is. You know.
And how are – well, I guess – so you're telling me, say like a kid in his basement uploads it, they'll be able to identify which band that is. And obviously he can't monetize that, but they'll – and in theory, they'll be sending that money back to the – how does that – the artist or the label then?
I guess if it's a track, it's supposed to go to the label. But it could, you know, so it's there. It's called fingerprinting, and they have ways that they can know who uploads things and stuff. It's still a little bit murky sometimes about, you know, kids that have paid channels or they're putting music up, if sometimes things fall through the cracks. And I'm still, in all honesty, I don't know that I trust YouTube 1,000% in terms of a lot of the stuff that they're doing. But it's supposed to be there, and they're supposed to take things down. Like there's a big thing – actually, it's happened to me a couple times on Facebook where I'll post something from YouTube, like a 30-second snippet of a new song or something. Facebook will actually take it down and say, you don't own the rights to this. I'm like, wait a minute. I do, but so I guess in some ways that's good. I don't know. It's still I think these companies are still trying to figure out that. That's the YouTube Facebook thing is still a little weird. But when you look at this the pure streaming companies, they're definitely doing it the right way. And look, if you look at the business model of it, for $10 a month you get every song you can ever imagine. You can listen to it pretty much wherever you want to. I mean, that's a pretty good deal. When I was growing up, it was $20 just buy one record.
Well, the biggest difference that I think out of it, and this is where I think it's done a huge benefit as opposed to a disservice, is I remember when I was a kid, like you couldn't – if someone recommended a band, they weren't on the radio. You'd have to go out – yeah, for the most part, you wouldn't be able to find it in the shops. Again, if I was lucky, I could find it through Columbia House. But a lot of the time, I Like, you know, I remember for the first few years when I was much younger, reading about bands like Cradle of Filth and like Hit Parader and Metal Edge, but having never seen an album or t-shirt of them anywhere and just sort of wondering, who are these evil looking dudes and where can I hear them? And I think that that idea where you can literally just type in a search and have the option to listen to them immediately now, is a pretty good deal.
No, that's really kind of a game changer. I think that's one thing where you see music, especially bands, have gotten to be so popular. I mean, maybe the music sales aren't there what they used to be, but people know who they are. They go to shows and they buy merchandise and they listen to songs. So these bands, you know, when you see a band like Amon Amarth, which is a kind of a heavier, you know, metal band that 15, 20 years ago wouldn't get the exposure they're getting now. And they're doing insane numbers. I mean, their new record just came out, debuted number one in Germany and Austria and Sweden and top five in a bunch of other countries, is number nine in the overall top 200 chart on the Billboard chart here in the U.S. I mean, these are things that if it wasn't for that access to music, probably wouldn't have happened.
Well, I think you touch on another point, which is really interesting, that because of digital, because you upload it and it stays out there forever, and now with sort of recommended things, it seems like this is now providing the opportunity to actually build bands in the way that you're talking about. Because I remember like Amon Amarth 2 going back probably like 2000, going like, yeah, I remember hearing about these guys. And as you said, like they're headlining Bloodstock and all these festivals across Europe now. And I'm like, if someone hadn't stuck with them, they wouldn't be around. But now after those sort of 10 albums, or even the way that people talk about Bolt Thrower these days too, like these, going back when I was much younger, they were sort of, you know, pretty far down the pile, but they are now the top of the heap where there's not many of those bands these days.
Sure. And you know, I think we take on, you know, a lot of the other labels do as well, take on the attitude of, you know, you're building, and it sounds super corporate to say it, but you're building a brand.
Mm.
And what we do is we work with, you know, the managers and the agents and everybody associated with the band. We're all on the same table. We're all pushing the car the same way. And if you have, you know, four wheels on a car going in the same direction, you're going to go pretty fast. If you don't, you're not. And so the bands that get successful, like Amon Amarth, they're one super smart guys, great band. They're continually making great music, but they're also surrounded by a bunch of really great people helping them to, you know, to become bigger. And, you know, we love to play a part in that. And our attitude is like, look, the bigger the band is on every level, then the more music they're going to sell.
What do you think? So again, going back to how this works now, you said like, there's obviously money to be made out of it. How are these deals, structured now with emerging artists? Because I remember hearing stories, you know, going back when it was still CDs and records, a lot of it was huge upfront cash payments that with records that typically didn't sell. So the band would need like 20 years to sort of get out of debt to the label. How does that work with digital assets? And my understanding is a lot of labels are now intrinsically involved in the touring and the merchandising and these what people are calling 360 deals.
Yeah, I think those are happening less and less now, because in all honesty, those deals are a joke. We've never done a 360 deal because we're not a merchandising company, you know, we're not a publishing company, we're not all these things that these labels do. And there's so many other things that other people are involved in doing that I think it's extremely arrogant for even the major labels to say, well, you know, we need to be a part of everything because we're doing all this work. Well, I mean, they are, but they really aren't at this point. So I think those are much less than they used to be. And the climate within the music industry is so much different now, where you just have, you know, labels falling all over themselves sometimes, kind of like you almost did in the 80s again. Because it's successful, you know, trying to make things happen. So I think those 360 deals have gone away, and the artists, if you have something going on, have a little bit more of a say and a little bit more a better negotiating point, I guess, than they used to. So I don't see a lot of those deals happening now. There's a few here and there, but unless you own a merchandising company and a booking agency and everything else, why should you be getting a piece of that? It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah,
and there's enough money being. And there's enough money being generated now in music that you don't really have to be involved in that other stuff.
So what's sort of the insight then? I see a lot of this now where record companies pop up and they're continually re-releasing in limited edition numbers of you know, say like printed vinyl in 300 numbers that they're selling for $300. Are these really hot sellers? Because I find it hard to imagine that you can really make good money after you get a decent graphic designer you know, the cost on doing a limited run of 300 and then sort of all the marketing around it. But these seem to be a very, over the last few years, these have really seem to be a popular thing that I see with a lot of, you know, hard rock and metal labels.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the appetite for vinyl is still there. I mean, I don't know about $300 for one piece of vinyl, but I do see, you know, we do a lot of these things too. We'll do, you know, and we do it, number one, because, I mean, you can make money out of it. It also, I mean, it's very expensive to make vinyl because there's not a lot of plants up there. It's extremely expensive to make it, all these sort of things. So we try to not do, I mean, we do a lot of vinyl, but we try to not go too crazy. But we get constant requests for fans like, hey, do this in multiple colors, do this in this color, do that in this and that color. And when you do a run of a classic record, whether you do 500 or 1,000 whatever, and, you know, I don't know, splattered blood vinyl or whatever,
yeah,
people freak out about it. I mean, we did a and we probably could have done way more. We did, and it kind of blew me away that it did as well as it did. We have this band called Sirodongo, which is this old underground band from, actually came around in the early 80s in Los Angeles, but kind of was a little bit different. They're like more progressive sort of thing. And they're having this bizarre renaissance now, 38 years later. So anyway, we did a cassette box set in Europe, and we only did 800 units of it. And we sold it out before it even came out. We probably could have done several thousand of them. So you'd be surprised what people want these days. Like, I highly doubt that those people are playing the cassettes.
Yeah. But they seem, again, they've come out of the blue. Cassettes are now seem to be on offer from some of these labels. And I'm just,
yeah,
I'm surprised by it. It seems like as soon as everyone had the opportunity to go minimalist with digital stuff, it's now created an appetite to own something again. It doesn't seem to matter what it is. They just want to buy it. So it's
yeah. I think, you know, there are collectors out there, they want to hold something in your hand, and that's the one thing you don't get with the digital stuff. You can't hold anything in your hand. You're just, you know, listening to it on a cloud. So I think that increases, the more you become a big fan of it, that it increases the fact that you want to have something where it's vinyl or cassette or even CD, something that you have actually, it's a living thing in your hand.
So we've got kind of a theme going on as we talk about sort of the business of music, and I might as well ask these questions as well. When the other thing that I noticed from a lot of labels these days is the geographies of how they're distributed. Who sort of owns the stuff? Because oftentimes, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but let's say I'll see a release from Metal Blade, for example, but then if I want to buy it across Europe, its distribution is through like Nuclear Blast, and then if it's in Asia, it might be Century Media. How does this sort of distribution works with who sort of owns it and who gets the rights to all this stuff these days?
Yeah, it can be a little tricky sometimes. So in general, you know, if you sign to Metal Blade or Nuclear Blast or whoever it is, in general, that's a worldwide thing. But we all, and it's changing a lot now. I mean, Century Media is owned by Sony. Relapse is owned by The Orchard, and now Nuclear Blast is owned predominantly by a company called, I forget the name of that, some big conglomerate company in Germany. So it's changing a little bit how the distribution goes. But sometimes there's several different reasons why you see that. Number one, there are a few bands that will want to partner with specific people in specific parts of the world because that's where they think that they're the best. And obviously, you know, Metal Blade's based in North America. So sometimes, you know, we'll just sign a band for North America and then maybe Nuclear Blast will have them for Europe and maybe somebody else will have them for Australia and Southeast Asia. You see that, you know, not all the time, but there are certain things where that happens. There's a few examples of that. And also the label sometimes will license products from the majors. For example, like we do a lot of licensing from Warner Brothers, where we've put out on vinyl most of the Roadrunner catalog now, including, you know, Type 1 Negative and Slipknot and, you know, all these things we've done vinyl because Warner's just doesn't have the capacity to do it, or they, for whatever reason, they're letting us do it. So yeah. So there's a lot of that sort of stuff too. So sometimes you'll see like, hey, why is Sepultura, an old Sepultura record on Metal Blade? Like, well, because we licensed the product from Warner Brothers. So the few reasons why you see that.
People like myself want to know, again, how that works. You pay like a fee per item and then you profit on the rest and you take the risk of it. Is that typically how these deals work?
Yeah, pretty much. If you're licensing something from the majors, they will want to get all the money up front. So we'll have to pay for everything up front. A lot of times they'll actually manufacture the record. So we pay for everything up front and then we keep our fingers crossed that we'll be able to sell them. Luckily, we've had very little problems with that. And because people have this insatiable taste for vinyl, it's been pretty lucky. And we've sold out of almost everything, and there's only a few things we haven't. But it is a little bit risky, especially with vinyl, because it's you know, you're writing a pretty big check to them and going, okay, well, we hope we'll make this money back. The other problem with that, too, that I find sometimes is that we also have to, because we're dealing with Warner Brothers. We're not dealing with the artists directly.
Okay.
So we kind of have to hope that Warner Brothers then is going to pay the bands, because we have had an issue a couple times where the bands never got any money from it because of whatever deal they had with Warner Brothers. And that kind of bums me out, because I don't want to, you know, we obviously want the bands to benefit from that.
And you don't want to be seen as that guy who's, yeah, skimming, I guess, for lack of a better term, off of some of this stuff.
Sure.
I forgot what I was going to ask. There was a very sort of good leading question that I wanted to – a couple months ago, I spoke with Satir from Satyricon when they were doing their Australian tour. We were talking about how these deals were structured. And he was saying the way that they're organized these days as a band, he's saying we get to retain the IP on it. And a lot of the deals that they organize are licensing deals with the labels. Is that reflective of Metal Blade, or do you still effectively own the IP? And how does it work with because some bands will record it at home in their own studios. Do you still send a lot of guys to the studios? How does all that work with margins and how and the cost of doing business these days?
Yeah, it really depends. I mean, there's so many different deals where a lot of it just depends on the artist and what they want and what they want from the label. Like if they want a huge, massive commitment from the label, then generally we want to own what we're getting. But if it's something like, hey, you know, we can record this ourselves and make it sound really good, and we'll license it to you for less money, but we want it back in 7 to 10 years. Like, okay, well we've done those deals since the beginning of Metal Mate, quite honestly. So it just really depends on the artist and what they're looking to do and how much money you're risking on those sort of things. And certainly a band like Satyricon that, by the way, their want, I'm a bit of a wine guy too. And
oh, Von Graven,
you see
a lot.
Yeah. A lot of the wines that people do as their kind of things are not very good, but Satyricon wine is really good. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, with a band like that, you know, they can go out there and say, hey, you know, we'll do this, but you know, we want to own it in the end. So sure.
Yeah. Fair. And where do you think the state is? I mean, you are a metal label. There's a few things I'm surprised at. First of all, there's not a lot of, maybe again, cause it's just that I'm older, but there's not a lot of people that I talk to that are really abreast of new music that's coming out in the scene. But when I read stuff online, for probably at least the last 10 years, I'm blown away that artists that have been around for 20 or 30 years are still charting at higher levels than they ever had in the past. As a label, do you feel that you guys, when you put out a band, are you marketing to convert new metal fans? Are you catering to existing Metal Blade fans, I suppose?
Well, clearly what we want to do is cultivate new fans, get new people on board. That's really what you want to do. I mean, you have to obviously keep the base happy and keep the people, you know, that know what's going on happy. But ultimately, you know, we want to recruit new people. And, you know, you do see that at shows. A lot of bands, and I love seeing this, a lot of bands will go at whatever show, hey, how many people is this the first time you're seeing us? For example, Metallica does that all the time, and Iron Maiden, or, you know, a lot of these bands do it. And you'd be always surprised that, you know, 25, 30% of the people holding up their hands for some first time seeing an artist. So that's good. And we like to see that. The reason why I think you see so many of the older artists that have been around for a long time charting so high is because it takes forever to develop an artist now. And we're seeing, you're talking about a 10 to 15 year commitment before a band that, you know, starts out as a baby band really gets to that next level. It's very, very difficult because there just aren't a lot of platforms that expose people to new music. You know, and even, you know, and the weird thing about Spotify and Apple Music is that when you do the analytics of them, people go to the band pages they already know. They don't go to the playlists like all the other genres, whether it's hip hop or pop or country or whatever. People go to playlists to kind of figure out what is the new thing. But we don't see that in rock and metal as much, and we're hoping that changes a little bit. But it does take forever. You know, I can't remember. I mean, the last time a band broke off of like a debut or second record, I mean, I don't know that that's really happened. It takes a long time. I mean, probably the biggest band that's breaking now is Ghost.
I was going to say that.
Five or six records.
Well, I thought they're still probably at the same level after their second that they have been. But, at least, you know, going back 5 years ago, they were still a headliner at, I want to say Donington, but Download. And I was surprised that after only – but again, imagery in heavy metal seems to be a big – part of, yep. of still what's selling and what's doing. It's a really good segue to my next question. That was, you know, I was living over in the UK for a few years, so I was lucky enough to go see a bit of these, you know, European festivals. But one of the things that I noticed and is still there is the headliners of all these festivals don't every 2 to 3 years, they're the same headliner again. There seems to be a really, really big glut between the big names who have been big names for 20 to 30 years and developing talent to fill that hole. And I think you know what yep. I mean by this. It's still the big four. Depending if it's health, Europe's a slightly different environment, but it's still filled by like Saxon and Aerosmith and Thin Lizzy and all these guys that are, you know, eventually they're not going to be around anymore. But I haven't seen outside of say Slipknot, there's not really been a band that debuted in the late 90s or early 2000s that has gotten that level, if that makes sense. And why is it so hard to fill this space? I mean, we see guys, you know, Behemoth seems to really finally be tracking to be something big. But again, they've been around for 20 years now. Why is it taking so long to get a breakout band in this genre?
I think there's a variety of reasons. I mean, number one is because the big bands still continue and exist at a high level, whether it's Iron Maiden or Metallica or Slayer or whoever. And those bands are all still at a very high level, performing phenomenally. So it's really difficult to kind of break down the barriers of that. So that's number one. I do believe, and you know, we talk about this all the time in the industry. I do believe that once, and look, all these bands are going away sooner than later. And Slayer, unfortunately, is done the end of this year. So somebody's going to have to go up. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to lift up the Behemoths and the Amon Amarths and the Ghosts and all these bands that are kind of getting to that level to be, okay, well, Iron Maiden's not playing arenas, and hopefully these other bands will start to get there. They're upping their show. They're upping their production values and everything. Like, for example, Amon Amarth was just out here in the U.S. with Slayer for about 4 weeks, and a lot of people I know that went that had never seen them before that were like, oh my gosh, Amon Amarth was amazing. We didn't know how good they were. So, you know, and they have huge production, almost as big as, not as much fire as Slayer has, but a pretty big production. So
yeah, I saw them like a couple of years. They had the multi-level stage with the fire and the explosions as well. I think that was Bloodstock again that I saw them at. But
yep. Okay. So it's getting there. It just takes a long time, and I think there's only so much money that people have to spend on those sort of events. And you know, when you still have Metallica around there and Iron Maiden, the tickets aren't cheap, and you know, you have the same headlines. It's not just a metal rock thing; it's in almost every genre of music. Where you know, where are the next headliners coming from? So we'll see.
It's interesting. Kiss is never going to quit. All these bands say it's their Ozzy was supposed to quit, never did. Sabbath was supposed to quit, never did. You really reckon Slayer's done?
Oh, I know they're done.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I know they're done. I won't go into the reasons why they're done, but they are definitely done. I think, look, for a lot of it is, you know, Kerry King's a really good friend of mine. He's one of the guys that his conviction to things is pretty impeccable. And if they say it's done, then it's going to be done. I would be shocked to my core if they in 5 or 6 or 7 years came back.
Well, I already heard, I saw an interview, and it already sounds like he's already looking at what he's going to do post-Slayer. And I'm sort of fascinated by that. And I know that he's a big Hatebreed fan, so I reckon Jast is going to be involved in it or something. But it'll be interesting. Now I know that we're getting short on time with you. You've still got stuff to do this evening, but I wanted to ask you a few questions, sort of as a fan and about the label, if you don't mind, outside
sure.
of business. Look, first one, as you mentioned, you had Slayer early on. I want to talk about one of the first Slayer albums that I got, which is that Live Undead record. that went through a lot of debate about why this album came out. Was it a studio album? Was it a live album? And the like. Frankly, I still think outside of which album I think of. I think the artwork on it is fantastic, with sort of the zombies coming out of the graveyard. What was going on at this album? Why did it have to come out? And why won't anyone admit that it's just a studio album? Or what was it?
Well, basically, right? So basically what it was is we had this opportunity to do I believe it was for a radio station in New York. Well, they wanted the band to go into a studio and have, you know, 50 kids in there watch them basically play live in a studio. So we kind of went around and thought, okay, cool. The band was kind of in the idea. And then when we went in and did it, we're like, well, shoot, this is so cool. Why should we just do this the one time? We're recording it. Why don't we, if it turns out any good, why don't we just put it out? So it turned out that it came out pretty good and we thought it was pretty cool. So we're like, well, might as well put it out. At that point, we needed to put stuff out because we didn't have a lot of money to go and record stuff. So in essence, it was almost a free thing to do. So it just kind of seemed to make sense to put it out.
Mm. I will mention 6 Feet Under, but I want to get your take on this first. What has Metal Blade ever at any point in time, have you tried to provide creative direction or do you let artistic merit run free? And what I'm leading into is certainly at different points in time, there must be albums where you went, shit, I can't believe we have to release this, or this is much better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much we let the bands do whatever they're going to do. I mean, I never understood that. Let's sign a band and then try to make them something different. It's like, we signed the band because you like the band the way they were. And the majors would do this all the time and just drive me crazy. So no, we don't do that. I believe in the freedom of the artist. They should say and do whatever they want. And again, if we're signing the artist, that they should do that. I mean, we give them, you know, some like, hey, it'd be cool if you maybe did something like this, or, you know, if you had the next record, we kind of, you know, took a little bit of a different direction, but it's always up to the artist. It's like, we'll give them little hints and say like, this might be cool if you did this. If they do it, cool. If they don't do it, that's fine as well. And I think that's good. It's a good relationship between the label and the artist because they don't feel that they're being pushed in to do something. But, you know, if we say, hey, this might be a kind of cool idea, we're all metal fans. So
yeah, because I go back to that. 6 Feet Under is the only band that I can actually think of on the label where each release I thought the quality got poor, where it just felt like it was being called in sometimes. And I was really disappointed because, again, those first few albums that they released were I think in a separate interview you mentioned even 6 Feet Under was doing better than Cannibal for a number of years.
Oh yeah, in their heyday in the mid-90s, they were doing huge numbers. Yeah, I don't know. You know, artists, and I love Chris Barnes. He's a great friend of mine, a really good guy. But sometimes they have different visions of what they want to do and how they want to do it. That maybe I don't think is the right way to do it. But I said, I'm not going to tell them that they can or can't do something. So we've seen that with a few other artists where they're just going. And there was also a time period where, you know, it would get really expensive to make records. And I think sometimes the artists were like, well, maybe I can make it for a little bit less and make more money on the back end. But the quality tends to suffer sometimes.
Okay. A couple more questions before I let you go then. This is going to be a very big band for you because there's a lot of stuff going on online, and there's also a lot of shit being thrown back and forth already about the legitimacy of them. Batushka and this Polish death metal band that's coming out between, I guess, originally a tour promoter and bar owner by the name of Bart, who now seems to run the band, and the disagreement between the supposed brains behind the actual band who's been locked out, Christoph, who's put this a video plate online. And what makes this so fascinating is they will put their first album out with you guys, I believe, in July. They have one full length before that, and this is the only black metal album that I've ever seen that's already got like 3 million views for a band that has put out effectively that. I think it was limited to 300 copies at the time. This assumedly is going to be a big release. I'm going to see them in Europe this year. But from what I can gather online, it may not actually be the real Batushka. And I want to see, I guess, what you think about this and what position this puts Metal Blade in.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate when these sort of things happen. You know, there's always disagreements with inside bands, and it's unfortunate when stuff like this happens. And it's a bummer for everybody involved. It reminds me in a lot of ways, really, of Ghost. I mean, when I first heard of and saw Batushka, it was from the guy who was the Ghost booking agent. He said, hey, you might be into these guys. They're kind of like the black metal version of Ghost. And I love theatrical stuff. I love mystery. And I was like, oh, my God, this is really amazing. So we ended up signing them. And I agree. I think it's this we're super excited. There's a massive amount of potential here. They've got all the right players involved and who's working with them, the right management, the right agents, the right everybody. And yeah, then all of a sudden, you know, one of the guys is not in the band anymore. And obviously he's not very happy. So he's launched a pretty interesting campaign about the whole thing. So, I mean, look, well, I guess we'll see what happens. I mean, like I said, I it's unfortunate. I mean, I'm, you know, we kind of came in after the fact on this thing, and there's not much I can really say about it. It's kind of, I'm sure it's going to become a legal issue at some point, but it is kind of interesting because, you know, on social media, for the most part, I rarely get anybody saying anything bad or anything crazy. It's usually pretty positive, but I definitely put a few Batushka things up there, and there's some armies of people out there that, that are not that are in one camp or the other. So I guess we'll see what happens. I mean, ultimately, the people will speak whether this is something that they think is legit and amazing or it's not. So that's kind of the way it's going to go. I mean, we feel pretty excited about it. You know, I've heard the new record and it's great, and the stuff they're doing in terms of the theatrics and all that sort of stuff is pretty cool. But like I said, we'll see where it ends up. It's unfortunate that it's come to this, and I feel bad for everybody. I'm hoping that they can all kind of sort it out at some point. But yeah, right now it's a little crazy.
Mm. All right, just to wrap up then, I mean, for anyone that's listening to this for the first time, it's clear that you're an insider. We've got, over the last few years, a lot of big names have disappeared. Hanneman, Dime many years ago, along with Peter Steele, Vinny recently, Dave Brockie, sort of in the medium term between those guys. Any particularly funny stories that you remember about any of these characters who make up our scene?
Oh boy, there's a lot of them. Time and Vinny were amazing guys, and I got to hang out with them quite a bit because we're all just huge metalheads in the end, and we hung pretty heavy. I have a lot of great Dime stories. I'll tell you one Dime and Vinny stories. I'll tell you one. There's a couple of them. Let me give you one real quick one. So I mentioned Lizzie Borden earlier in the podcast here. He's a good friend of mine and been around forever. He's got a new record out and doing touring and all this sort of stuff. But anyway, we were in Phoenix, and I used to have a house in Phoenix, so we go out and hang out in Phoenix quite a bit. So we were in Phoenix, so we went to a certain strip club in Phoenix, and Liz and I were there. And I look over, and it's like all the guys from Pantera sitting across from us. I'm like, oh, wow, cool. So I walked over, and I said, hey, man, how's it going? I said, hey, man, come on, sit with us. So I'm like, cool. I said, I'm with my buddy Lizzie Borden. You mind if he comes? They're like, Lizzie Borden's here? They're huge Lizzie Borden fans.
Yeah.
So I'm like, all right, cool. So as they want to be, they love to get people completely wasted on shots.
Pissed. Yes. The Black Tooth.
The Black Tooth, or I can't remember if the Black Tooth or Jägermeisters that night, but one of the two, they got Lizzie pretty bad. So at one point in the evening, I go, what happened to Lizzie? I haven't seen him for a while. And we're like, I don't know. So I walked out front, and he was literally in the parking lot, laying down in the corner, like barely able to stand or anything. They got him so wasted. So I went back in and told him, I said, yeah, I think I got to take Lizzie home. He's not doing too well. And they, of course, were roaring in laughter and loved it. That our mission is complete. So yeah, those guys would do that. In fact, the only time I ever missed a flight in my entire life was I was hanging out with them in Anthrax in Hawaii, of all places. And the last night was the same thing. Like Dime was running around with and Vinny both were running around with bottles of Jägermeister and basically walking up to people and said, you're going to drink it or you're going to wear it. So I drank so much Jägermeister that night, I missed my flight the next day, which that's the only flight I've ever missed in my entire life, of a thousand flights. So those guys were super fun.
You reckon that Pantera 4th video will ever see the light of day? There's been a few sort of teasers for it over the last year or so.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I mean, now, obviously with Vinny passing away, it's a whole different dynamic now about, rights and making sure everybody gets paid the right way and all that sort of backroom stuff. But I hope so. I hope so. By the way, a quick Brockie story, because I love Brockie. He was a brilliantly funny guy. I was on I went to go see Guar somewhere. I can't remember where it was. But I got there early, and we were hanging out on the bus, and we watched this movie Bad Lieutenant before, which is with Harvey Keitel.
From 91. I remember that with the nun and everything. Yeah.
yeah, pretty legendary movie. So we watch it right before they go up on stage. And so I go in and watch the show, and literally Dave Brock is acting out almost the entire movie on stage of between songs. No, I don't think anybody has any clue what, because he doesn't mention it. He's just doing all the scenes from the movie and stuff. And there's a few people that got it, but I think most of the people are like, what is this guy doing? And of course, I was dying in laughter. Like, after the show, I went up to him. That was one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen. So, yeah, it was fun.
Fair enough. I've got one quick thing I'll ask you after I shut off the mic, but Brian Slagle, it's been awesome, and I hope people take something away from this. And look, all the best to the label. You sound like you're one of the few guys that that's in it for the artist, which is quite a rarity.
Thanks. We're trying.